Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We're going to talk about a controversial issue here right now, okay? So sit down and listen to this. I read this earlier in the week and was intrigued by it. A writer for The Guardian says he hates being a black man. I want to read some quotes from Orville Lloyd Douglas. He writes, "I can honestly say I hate being a black male. I just don't fit into a neat category of the stereotypical views people have of black men. In popular culture, black men are recognized in three areas: sports, crime, and entertainment. I hate rap music. I hate most sports. And I like listening to rock music such as PJ Harvey." So I want to bring in the author right now. His name is Orville Lloyd Douglas. He joins me in Toronto. I guess you can call it self-hatred. Who do you blame for your self-hatred?
I would say that I think it manifests from society, I would say.
When I read through all of that, and you're saying you hate being a black man, do you hate being a black man, or do you just hate the stereotypes about black men?
I hate the stereotypes about black men. There's in pop culture, the stereotypical image of a black male is to be aggressive, is to be arrogant, is to not be a nice person. And I just feel like as though there are a lot of black males out there, such as myself, who don't conform to those sexist and racist stereotypes.
Do you really not want to be black anymore? Is that what you're saying?
No.
If you could change it, would you change it to some other race? Would you be white? I mean, what are you saying here?
No. No, what I'm saying is that you have to remember that I'm a Canadian. I'm not an American. And you have to remember that in Canada, there are less than 1 million blacks in Canada. Canada is a very Eurocentric country. I mean, the image of Canada people have is of hockey, Molson beer, cold winters. You know, black Canadians were really at the, we're kind of like at the margins of Canadian society. It's not like the United States, where there are African Americans make up 12% of the United States population, and there's close to 40 million blacks in the United States. The total population of Canada is only 33 million. So when you grow up in a country where you don't really see a lot of positive images about black people, it does affect you. And that's why, that's where I'm coming from when I wrote the article.
Gosh, I could talk to you all night, because in a way I understand what you're saying about the stereotypes about being black. But shouldn't that push you to learn more about yourself and to love yourself more? I understand the stereotypes, and even coming from other black people, they expect you to be a certain way, right? And when you don't fit into that category, then all of a sudden you're not black, which is a bunch of bull. But go on, and I'll follow up.
Okay, well, what I wanted to say is that I think that this is just my perspective as a black Canadian, that some African Americans have this perspective that they are the de facto black people of the world. And what African Americans need to understand is that in different countries, black people experience blackness differently. And I think it's really, I stress this, because In Canada, it's just so different. And Canadians are very uncomfortable talking about race. I tried to get this article published in a Canadian newspaper, but I didn't get a response. In Canada, Canada has like this engenders this mythology that that we don't have problems with racism. I actually think the United States is more progressive in the sense that in America, people are not afraid to talk about race. But in Canada, people are very uncomfortable talking about these kind of issues.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, October 12th, 2016. So I have been told. The audio segment you heard at the beginning of the program, that was from 2013, the legend Don Lemon of CNN. He was having an interview with Mr. Orville Lloyd Douglas. This is a black male. He had a piece published in The Guardian. This is 2013 about why he hated being a black male. And as you heard, this is a black male. He resides in Canada, and talking about, you know, his experience with racism, white supremacy in North America, a little further north than I think what we typically talk about. Our guest for the program this evening, he not only wrote about that incident, that piece that Mr. Douglas authored, but he has written a lot about racism, white supremacy in Canada. He is a bilingual attorney in Canada. He does work in social affairs, social justice. He advocates on many issues for black people specifically, black Canadians. He also authored the charter on black people's representation in media. It's titled Charter on Media Representations of Black Peoples. You can check it out online. Bullet points itemized about the importance of how black people are projected, depicted in media, and even defining what he means when he says media. Real pleasure to have him on the program. Joining us live from Canada, Mr. Anthony Morgan. Mr. Morgan, are you with us, sir?
Hi, how are you doing? I'm really honored to be on the program. Thank you for having me.
Oh, the honor is ours. We are glad to have you with us, sir. For some of our listeners, both Canada and the States, this might be their first time hearing from you. Just anything that you think would be important for listeners to know about who you are, the work that you do?
So you gave me quite a glowing introduction. I appreciate that. So there's not much more I can say to that other than, I'm a lawyer in the city of Toronto. I was born and raised in Canada. I've just been committed to addressing issues of anti-black racism within Canada for a few years now, and I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight.
Me too. Canadian listeners, encouraged to dial in, get your questions. I think it's obvious, but just making sure, you are a black male, yes?
Yes, I am a black male.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition, a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Hello?
Oh, did you?
As far as my understanding goes, in terms of looking at... Hello?
Oh, we can hear you. Yes, sir.
Okay, you can hear me just fine?
Yes, sir.
I think it's an accurate articulation of systems of oppression on the basis of race that privilege and empower white people or people who identify themselves as white or enjoy the benefits of white privilege to the detriment of the rest of us. So I think it's accurate in that sense. I would say, though, and this is coming from my own background within Canada and understanding Canadian law on questions of racism and discrimination more broadly, whether that be on the basis of disability or queer identity or nationality, language, things of that sort. Within our Canadian law, we tend to move away from any language when any language that would suggest intention or deliberate action on the part of the person who is engaging as the oppressor. When you use the word dedicated to within your definition of white supremacy, that gave me pause, because that would actually not be consistent with our own understandings of white supremacy in Canada. So what I'm getting at is we are very clear that you can be engaging in white supremacy without the intention. So you don't even need to be dedicated toward. You could be totally acting oblivious to your white privilege, but if those actions still have the impact of subjugating people of color, black folks, indigenous people, who you might in the States refer to as Native Americans. We tend to refer to them as indigenous here. But if you do that, even if you don't have the intention or ill will towards those people, that could still be considered discrimination or an expression of white supremacy. And so while I definitely think it's a powerful and important definition, as you articulate it, based on our own developments and our theories and ways in which we construct and articulate systems of racism, power, privilege, on the spectrum of white supremacy, we would add to it, I would say, from the Canadian perspective, and say, you know what? You don't even need to be dedicated towards this thing. You just need to be an actor within it. If any of your actions form a part of that system, then you are implicated.
Right on. I appreciate the thoroughness in just reminding our listeners, Mr. Morgan is an attorney. Words are very important for individuals who practice law. Just two quick points that I wanted to make. I do consistently on our program, I discourage our listeners from using the term white privilege when discussing white supremacy, racism. Just in my opinion, what is being practiced in Canada and worldwide is not a reflection of white privilege. I think, in fact, that greatly minimizes when we talk about incidents. You have a great report on the Huffington Post Canada. Does this Nova Scotian premier hate black people? And you have a list of different incidents that give a broader pattern of what I would call not white privilege, white terrorism, white supremacy against black people in Canada. And number one on your list is Shelbourne, the first incident of white terrorism, a purge of black people from Shelbourne. This is in the 18th century. And then I'm skipping down. You have a lot of other things listed, but you also have the cross-burning incident in Nova Scotia in 2010. I would suggest those two incidents to me illustrate, number one, white privilege is not the most accurate term. Like, I would not say that Shelbourne is an example of white privilege. I would not say that a 2010 cross burning is white privilege. I would say that's white terrorism, white supremacy. And the intentionality part, like 1,000%, I get it totally. It makes logical sense in terms of you can be culpable without you having intended to do harm. I totally understand that from a legal sense, but I think just in a sense of being as accurate as possible about white supremacy, Shelbourne is an intentional act of anti-black racism. That cross-burning incident is an intentional act of anti-black racism, and I submit that all of these manifestations, systemically, Andrew Locu, all of this is being done with great planned attention from individuals who classify themselves as white. And I think that gets minimized or out and out rebuked all the time. And I think that's false. In my view, it's that important to clarify this is being done deliberately. This is not an accident. This is not unconscious. This is deliberate terrorism, anti-black racism. Your response?
Yeah, I would say on those instances of like outright anti-black violence, I would never characterize that as white privilege. I think the notion that you could do it and get away with it might engage white privilege, and I recognize and I respect the importance of not using that language, but I think there's room for it in the discussion and making the distinction. So Shelbourne, Colburn or the Cole Harbor fights or riots or Auburn fights that are listed in that article, or just cross burning anything of that sort. I don't think that is that could be accurately characterized as white privilege. So I certainly take your point. Those are acts of white supremacy, white terrorism. Very clearly, they're meant to send the message that black people, your bodies, your lives can be taken away from you, and we have the power to do that, and we will show you so in very horrific symbols to control you. So I would agree with you on that, but I would still say that there's room for a discussion on the unearned benefits of a system of that has privileged whiteness. And so I would identify that as white privilege. So I think there's room in the discussion and in understanding the constructions for our liberation for both of those terms through this. But we have to be particular and sophisticated in where we use those labels. We can't use them interchangeably is what I'm saying.
Okay.
So I definitely don't use them interchangeably.
Got it. Would it be?
A concrete example that's coming to mind is a black couple walks into a bank, asks for a loan, say two couples. Black couple, white couple, same financial situation, generally the same background, same resumes, and they want to launch the same kind of business. Let's say it's a restaurant. Let's even make it further and say it's the exact same restaurant. So the denial of the black family's access to a loan by the bank, I think that is anti-black racism. But for the white partners that did get the loan, they weren't engaging in any kind of act of, I would say, white terrorism or anti-black violence, but they do have white privilege in that circumstance that they won't even question. They'll just be happy. They'll think that, like, this is what you do. You walk into a bank, you have solid financials, and you get your mortgage or you get your loan. You get that extended credit. So in those kinds of ways, I would see the bank, the denial by the bank being an expression of anti-black racism, while they give the loan and the access to the white couple, in those circumstances, definitely, I would say that is problematic. That's anti-black racism. But for the white couple themselves, just as the recipients of those benefits, I would say that is white privilege, because they get to walk away without even considering the impact that their race had on that interaction.
I see. I don't want to get bogged down into this. Just the only thing I would say quickly is that I submit that white couple that goes to the bank that gets their loan approved, that they are aware, and in fact, that white couple, one of those members could be one of the enforcement officers that shot Jermaine Carby or Andrew Loku. That's what I mean, that just identifying as white is an act of violence. That was what was stated by one of our guests earlier this week, that you are a part of. Like, it's that white person that goes and gets the loan. His white friends and white family members run the bank. Like, he is a part of the system that deliberately guarantees that black people are not going to get the same types of loans worldwide. That's not just a problem in Canada. This is U.S. That's what I mean. It's the same thing. It's just a more refined version of Shelbourne with the same impact, crippling black people.
Yeah.
But
I definitely can appreciate and respect that fully.
Okay. Would it be accurate to put Orville Lloyd Douglas and the article that he wrote about hating being a black person, would it be accurate to say that Shelbourne, the cross hanging, all of that contributes to a black person, a black male in this instance, coming to this opinion that, man, I hate being black?
Yeah, I definitely think that is part of it. We are inundated. We have so many symbols coming at us and messaging and images that come at us being black people that would suggest that we are less than, that we're less valuable, that we're not even human. Our lives are of no value or no worth to the systems of power, but also just more generally within society. And so we can internalize some of that negative messaging, because it's so widespread, it's always there. And so some of us, like Orville Douglas, you internalize that message and you start to feel that you are those things that you are constructed to be by these outside forces. So black men are, and he used some of the stereotypes. And where I'm sure many of your listeners across the border, Canada and the States, the stereotypes are essentially the same: violent, shiftless, aggressive, irresponsible financially, sexually. Just there's so many negative constructions of blackness, but also particularly black maleness, which was what he was responding to in that story. So yeah, I think that that general culture and societal piece needs to be paid attention to, and I think that's why we have to be sensitive about the images that we project in media. These are not just symbols that are out there and it's all harmless and entertainment, fun and games. But when you have that, an overabundance of those negative images, and then you have a lack of positive imagery that constructs blackness within all of its dynamic form and complexities, then you will have this tendency of folks to treat themselves negatively if they are black, and treat other black folks negatively in their own community, and having to deal with that on top of these white supremacist structures that treat us harmfully.
I'm hopping topic here just a bit, because this seemed, your response, it seems very much related to, in a recent article, you mentioned your favorite film being Bamboozled. It just seemed very much related, what you just shared, to the point in that film. Is that your favorite film? And if so, why?
Yeah, it's definitely my favorite film. It's a great film in and of itself. I wouldn't say it's the greatest film of all time. It just happens to be my favorite. And why that is when that film hit me, I was at a particular stage in my development and trying to figure out who I was as a black man. And I didn't have the language. I didn't have the ideas that I could articulate to say there's something I feel off about this push towards me needing to be more hood, or me needing to be one of, in Canada would say the mandem. So you might say, so with, it was in Jamaican vernacular, mandem is man's them, like one of the guys on the block, essentially, or needing to, be with multiple women at an early stage of my, so this is high school that this movie came to me, or when I first saw it, it certainly came out before then. But I'd only seen it when I was I was maybe 14, 15, and it clued into me like that there is actually a system at play where there are other people benefiting from black people, and particularly thinking about my own position, black men, acting in negative ways, ways that don't advance the interests of ourselves or our community, but serve the prison industrial complex, or serve the ad revenues for newspapers, because we're doing things that they can publish our photos or publish our stories that can get readership and then sell more ads, and just different systems that don't benefit us. So that when Spike Lee's Bamboozle came to me, I was really awakened. I was awakened, and I said, you know what, I'm going to do my utmost to make sure that I don't fall into those negative stereotypes or perpetuate them unconsciously, because there are, I think, stereotypes that you can perpetuate consciously, and there are stereotypes that you unconsciously can participate in.
Interesting. Wow. Michael Rapp.
But I just wanted to have that awareness of how I'm representing myself and how that reflects on us as a people.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, Bamboozled. Michael Rapaport, one of the stars in that film. Kind of getting back on topic, although it's very much related, the piece that you wrote about Orville Douglas, a big theme of that piece was how he was not able to get that article published in Canadian media. He had to go to The Guardian, which is a UK publication, and you were saying that there's a reluctance to want to talk about, to address racism in Canada, a point you've already emphasized today. Now, this was 2013. Have things changed in any way in the 3 years since you wrote it, with everything that's happened with Black Lives Matter Toronto and what's gone on the last 2 years or so?
I would say there have been very small and incremental steps, but steps nonetheless to open up the conversation on anti-black racism. So it's slowly, and I stress it's slowly becoming more mainstream, than I would say it was in 2013. So even the word anti-black racism, I think if you put it in print or if you said it on a television, in a media interview, folks would look at you blankly and be confused. But because of a lot of the amazing work of the Black Lives Matter movement here in Toronto and their affiliates across Canada, that language is becoming more mainstream and government has actually started to adopt it more consistently when they're talking about issues affecting us. They still need to be pushed by us, so they might say racism, and we will call back and say, hey, no, we're talking about anti-black racism because it's targeted specifically black people. So, yeah, there has been movement on it, but there's still a long way to go.
Hmm. In that piece on Mr. Douglas, you wrote, asking rhetorically, where is Canada's Don Lemon? Is Desmond Cole Canada's Don Lemon? He's on News Talk 1010, and he writes for The Star. He had that piece that got all the awards, The Skin I'm In, talking about how he's experienced racism as a black male. Is he Canada's Don Lemon?
Well, I know Desmond personally, and I wouldn't want to offend him by calling him Canada's Don Lemon. Because Don Lemon's got a spotty record when it comes to affirmations of blackness. I'll be honest, I don't follow his career closely, but I've definitely seen clips where I'm like, what is this that he's talking about? That stuff I don't agree with. So like, but that doesn't make me say he is not black or anything like that. But I think there he has a kind of way of understanding his own blackness, which I would personally argue would not be in the best interest of us as a collective to adopt. But that's him. When it comes to Desmond Cole, who is a journalist here in Toronto, who's written some articles, a lot of articles actually, but one in particular that really blew open the conversation in the last year and a half or so about being black in Canada, he has been more consistently aligned with an understanding of his own blackness and the blackness of us as a people and how it interacts with Canadian society that I think is more progressive and healthy and self-loving and self-affirming of us as black people than you would might typically see with the Don Lemon.
I see. We try to include a lot of segments from Desmond Cole weekly. He talks about racism, white supremacy weekly. He's followed the Andrew Locu case. He's had lots of members of Black Lives Matter Toronto on his radio program, and he's written about the incidents and the updates with the Andrew Locu police shooting case. He's done a lot of very constructive work, in my opinion, Mr. Desmond Cole. One of the things where you were talking about Black Lives Matter Toronto in a piece you authored where you were talking about the hashtag Black Lives CDN syllabus. And I thought this was a great post. Again, the significance of this program being named Context of White Supremacy, it says that you created the hashtag largely because there seems to be a lot of confusion and misinformation about Black Lives Matter and what they were doing and how it related to the broader black experience. Studies in black history help put what's happening now in a bigger context. What sort of context did you want to provide for Black Lives Matter Toronto?
So my reaction to creating the hashtag, as you mentioned, was realizing how little folks really knew or appreciated about the things that black people had done in Canada and also the experiences black people were having within Canada. So I really wanted to centralize us and our experiences of anti-blackness, whether that be in child welfare systems, within the system of education, within policing, prisons, healthcare, even transportation, if you look at where buses go and where they don't go and how frequently they come. I wanted that context to be drawn so people could understand that what Black Lives Matter is doing is calling attention to an experience of blackness that Canadian society generally is very hesitant and often loath to meaningfully engage to actually say, okay, black people, this is your reality. We are going to construct policy or we are going to respond to it in this kind of way. Within Canada, it happens very little. There's a lot of hesitation because we like to situate ourselves as much better than the United States. We have what I call Canadian racial exceptionalism. We'll say that, hey, at least we didn't have slavery. At least we didn't have segregation. At least we didn't have lynching. The funny thing is, though, is that we did have these things. Well, I shouldn't say funny, but the actual fact of the matter is that we did have these things. It's hardly funny. It's not funny at all. But we like to believe, and we tell ourselves over and over these myths about what Canada is and how great we are on the questions of race. But it's not true. And so the hashtag was created to marshal different resources, bring them together under a hashtag. So if people wanted to talk about Black Lives Matter in a way that was, I would argue, responsible, then they would at least have a set of materials they could draw from and say, oh, I understand where this resistance is coming from and why they're agitating in the way that they are.
Fascinating. I would, again, point to the list, even though it's not connected to context for Black Lives Matter, but the report you had, does this Nova Scotian premier hate black people? That list is a great context for historical anti-black racism, white terrorism against black people. Just two of the incidents that I mentioned at the beginning, just to really give some of that context for the history of the black Canadian experience, the Shelbourne incident, and just from the article that you linked to in Black Loyalist, it talks about this all starting a black reverend baptizing a white woman, and this kind of starts the furor. Can you kind of share this experience with our listeners?
Yeah, so we're talking about a settlement of, so again, a lot of people don't know that black people have been in Canada since at least the 1600s. But this story is talking about the story about Shelbourne. So fast forward about over a century. So we're looking into the 1700s, early 1800s, that time. And so you have a black settlement in Shelbourne, Nova Scotia, and you have these black folks who've actually come up as part of the agreement to settle the American Revolution against, so American independence, sorry, not the yeah, certainly not the Civil War, sorry, but the American Revolution against Britain. Some of those British folks were allowed to take their slaves and other black people north to Canada and settle. And so Shelbourne was one of those settlements of black folks who had come as slaves, but some of them as free people, and settled up there. And eventually there was a lot of tension about these black people taking the jobs of white people. And eventually that racial resentment, which we've seen continues through today, led to what we know to be the first race riot in actual North America. Actually, one of the, an article I recently read is that as far as we know, well, there's almost certainly others, that is the first recorded in the, like, outright overt race riot. And it's white people rising up against black folks to terrorize them for taking their jobs, essentially. Like, how dare you Negroes come up here and take what we feel is ours?
Hmm. Would it be most accurate? Because that's the same term that's used for a lot of those incidents that happened here in the States, like Rosewood and Tulsa, Oklahoma, Black Wall Street, and many, many times over. But they use that same term, race riot. Do you think it would be more accurate to call that an incident of white terrorism? Because I think race riot gives the connotation like this is kind of an equal brawl, like white people and black people were duking it out, and, you know, that's sort of between equals.
And that's a neutral, equal-footing thing.
Right. Do you think white terrorism, would that be a more accurate term to describe what happened in Shelbourne?
Not only more accurate, it's simply more honest. Mm. If you look at what actually happened, black people weren't looking for a fight. This incident in Shelbourne of white terrorism, these white people actually went to the settlement of black people. So they displaced themselves to find themselves. They exercised their fury, their anger, their frustration, their violence and terrorism in a black settlement. They lived a ways away, not far enough that they couldn't walk, obviously, but they got there and they decided to burn church settlements, homes, violate people. It was horrific. So this is obviously an act of terrorism, and it was to discipline the black population at the time. So yeah, I think incidents like that are Rosewood, Black Wall Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma. These are all instances of white terrorism, and I think we need to be honest and recognize it as such.
Absolutely. Just reading from the site, and this is one that you linked from your article, where they're talking about what happened in Shelbourne, and significant paragraph what I said about the baptism, the role that that played in this. They write, David George was the leading Baptist minister among the blacks. He had a large following and was preaching in Shelbourne in what was called Blacktown. People weren't too concerned about what sort of message George preached to his own color, but when he began baptizing whites, the settlers were furious. In one instance, a white woman was about to be baptized when a mob arrived and tried to drag her away. Authorities intervened and decided that by the guarantees of freedom of religion, she could be baptized in whatever manner she chose. The mob left the scene, taunting George with threats. And this mob continued to run off all the black people, which is a very common theme throughout North America. Killing, beating, terrorizing entire towns of black people to defend a white woman. Is that, yes, Miss, any response you wanted to add?
Yeah, that was definitely a part of it. In terms of my reading of that source and others, that was really just an excuse. That tension really exists. And I, of course, if we think about the writings of Ida B. Wells Arnett, she talked about the threadbare lie of black men looking to do things sexually with white women and ravage them. And so that we also have that tradition that is creeped north of the border. And so that was part of it. But the larger context was just outright resentment towards black people. And so when these instances of Baptist happened, of black preacher and white folks, that just gave them the excuse to roll in on the community and express their frustration. But interestingly enough, if you fast forward or come more to present time, in the 1900s, we have our own case too, where the first known movement of the KKK was not far from where I am now in Toronto, about say 50 kilometers. Or I don't know what that is in miles, not far away, about a 45-minute drive outside of Toronto, we have an incident where you have a black man in the city of, again, I think it was Hamilton, who was with a younger white woman, and you had the KKK drive up from another city outside of Toronto to burn a cross and let him know that he will be lynched if he tries to continue his relationship with this woman. So we have these stories that go back to 200 years, right up to the more present time realities, where there's that racial resentment, particularly around black men and white women, and the anxiety that causes, and then sparking its own kind of violence. And that wasn't he wasn't lynched. Eventually, he was saved by a lot of advocacy from the black community that rallied around to support him, but he could have very well been lynched in Ontario.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, indeed. And just FYI for our listeners, 50 kilometers is roughly 31 miles. Right on. You wrote in 2013 how the Trayvon Martin tragedy would have looked in Canada. You wrote, While I'm not of the firm belief that in general it is much better to be a black, let me make sure I read it correctly. I don't want to misquote. While I'm of the firm belief that in general it is much better to be a black male in Canada than it is in the U.S., Canada does in fact have a long and continued history of exonerating white people who have brutalized, shot, and or killed a black person, especially males, in the context of policing. There's that word again. 2016, do you stick with that it is much better to be a black male in Canada than it is in the U.S., and why?
It's funny. I'm hesitating because I'm not so sure anymore, honestly, and to the point where I want to say, it's tough to take that position so firmly. I was younger. I was in my early 20s when I wrote that. But I've evolved as I've come to really appreciate the context of anti-blackness that we're facing here. It in a way that it doesn't really make sense to make comparisons of better or worse, because it's just anti-blackness, right? And so a little bit of violence doesn't mean that the violence doesn't hurt as much. It's still violence. And so I would say now that while it's definitely different in terms of scale a number of incidents. If you actually start controlling for things like population size, presence of Black people in this space, and our own ability to thrive within Canada, it starts to look a lot more like the United States. So I wouldn't take that position as emphatically as I did when I was younger. But I do think it is important to recognize different. I'm not going to say it's exactly the same as the U.S., because anti-Blackness is real here. What the bigger point of that article, though, was really looking at the way the experiences of Indigenous people or Native Americans are actually really extreme when it comes to other kinds of violence that starts to look a lot like the kind of violence you see in the States. Of course, there was anti-Indigenous or violence against Native Americans in the States, horrific violence, but within Canada here, we have not reckoned with that. And so that's what I was trying to signal to within that piece about what a Trayvon Martin situation would look like in Canada.
Got it. I think since the time that you wrote this article, the Colton Bushi case might be somewhat close to what happened to Trayvon Martin. This was a 22-year-old non-white male. He was in a car. If I remember, I think it either broke down or somehow they ended up stopped on Gerald Stanley's farm. This is a white man, Gerald Stanley. He's in his 50s. And he shoots and kills Colton Bushi. The significant extra in this piece is that former councilman Ben Kautz, he posted online about this incident where a 22-year-old unarmed non-white male was shot and killed. He posts online that the only mistake Stanley made was... wait for it. Leaving witnesses. He has subsequently resigned after the furor. But this happened this year. They had Andrew Loku, who was a black male. He had some mental health issues. He was shot and killed by police. Desmond Cole did a lot of great reporting on that, continues to do so, where they got the SIU report. A lot of the Black Lives Matter Toronto efforts around this case and getting information that generally would not be released. The Special Investigations Unit report, where they found that the police attempted to tamper with the video recording of the shooting. A lot, again, and I think Black Lives Matter Toronto, if they had not been so active, that information wouldn't have come out. I think Desmond Cole did great reporting on that as well. What are these, Jermaine Carby, I think there's some of the other police shooting incidents that have gotten a lot of attention. What are these incidents? What have they revealed about racism in Canada?
That it exists, and you can't deny it. And to deny it is its own act of violence. And so you have reporting has been done about. So the Toronto Star, probably the most widely read paper in all of Canada, has done its own independent journalism to show that. When we look at black people within the city of Toronto, Canada's largest city, of course, black males represent some 8% of the population now, but if you look at the representation of black males and incidents of police use of lethal force, so killing killing someone, we represent at least 50 to 60% of those numbers. And why it fluctuates is that Canada refuses to collect official data and systematize it and then release it to the public. So they will know that a person is black, but they won't collect stats and like check boxes to say, okay, this is another black person killed by police. So it's left to lawyers, researchers, journalists to sort of aggregate that information. So when the Toronto Star did that in their report, they showed that black males are dramatically overrepresented in police use of lethal force incidents, so police killing people. So you have a population of black people that is quite small, actually, when you compare it to the States, for instance, but still we are more than half of the people who are killed by police. And so you have to wonder, how can that be? And my argument would be, and I think many folks within Canada, Black Lives Matter, Desmond Cole, different folks doing this advocacy work would say, it's anti-black racism. But also when we look at the Colton Bushi incident, we have to say that, of course, there's still the consistency, unfortunately, is that anti-Indigenous racism is also violent within Canada. And so you'll have this kind of cavalierness that this counselor could show about the murder that was actually a Native or an Indigenous young man, and he was with other Indigenous kids And so they too should have been killed, because that's how you deal with problematic natives or problematic indigenous people, young people. You just kill them. You just shoot them dead and leave their bodies, and someone will clean it up. And so racism is still very present, and we see it in that incident.
That would be another instance where I would say white privilege, not the most accurate term, what happened with Colton Bushi, Andrew Loku, any of those incidents. Desmond Cole, one of the major points that he's been making consistently is that Canadian media spent a lot of time talking about Trayvon Martin and Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, Eric Garner, a lot of the shootings that have took place in the U.S., but they were not as...
Yeah, Michael Brown, Eric Garner.
Right. But they were not as enthusiastic about covering some of the incidents that happened in Canada. Andrew Loku, Jermaine Carby. Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case. It's funny. Desmond and I have started to do this just as an internal cross-reference. When there's a killing of a black person, or a black person is seriously violated by police within Toronto, within Toronto or in Canada, we know that we'll get calls here and there, but it won't be too much. But when a black person gets killed on camera in the state, we lose an entire day doing media interviews within Canadian networks that fall over themselves to give in-depth, sweeping, comprehensive coverage of violence, racial violence and racial terrorism, anti-black terrorism in the U.S. So Canada is not willing to show the same fervor and interest in broadcasting that here, because, again, we have a lot invested in Canada in this idea, this national mythology of us being so great, so welcoming. And so one of the running stories about Canada, almost every person across Canada knows, is the Underground Railroad, right? So slaves escaping the United States to find freedom in Canada. And so that's the image we like to freeze in our mind about what Canada is, this place of refuge for black people. But the Underground Railroad lasted anywhere between 30 and 50 years at most. But slavery on these same territories lasted for 206 years. So it goes to show you that we are so invested in this comparatively a very small time, this 30 to 50 years versus 206 years of enslaving black people on this land.
Well said. Well said. In that same context, are you familiar with Sawin Peters, the attorney in Canada?
I am, yes.
Oh, okay. Can you tell our listeners about his recent incident where he was denied access to the Law Society of Canada?
Yeah, so recently, Selwyn Peters, he's a black lawyer who's done a lot of... work addressing issues of anti-black racism, racial profiling, discrimination against black people in employment, and of course in the policing context. And so he was going to the Law Society, and the Law Society is the organization that runs the legal profession. And so lawyers go in and out of there all the time. There are courts that are attached to it. And so one particular day, he was giving a tour to one of the students he had just hired, who I also think was another black student. And so he was about to enter the doors of the Law Society, this building, which he's probably been in hundreds of times. And the security guard approached him in what he says was a very hostile and rude, aggressive way, presuming that Mr. Peters, Selwyn Peters, had no business there or was not a lawyer, in fact. Because I should say that Selwyn, we know each other personally, so I can call him Selwyn, he doesn't fit the stereotypical image of what a lawyer looks like. He's about 6'2", dreadlocks, large beard, glasses. So he, and this is what he also argued, is that in the security guard's mind, this man who's presenting in this way, regardless of whether or not he's wearing a suit, he just physically couldn't possibly be a lawyer. So he started to ask someone all these questions, asking for his lawyer's ID. Eventually, it was found that his card was expired, so the security guard sent him on his way to get a new card. So Selwyn challenged that with the Law Society, and he's brought a human rights complaint against the profession, which, if you think about that, that's quite bold. because it's the profession that regulates all lawyers. So if you create enemies there, it could have an impact, right? And so we all think about ways in which we're vulnerable. But he really clearly doesn't care. He's willing to stand up for the larger principle of eliminating racial profiling. And so that's that case there. And it should be noted that he actually had a similar run-in at another court building, I think some 4 years ago, and he won that case. And it was a precedent-setting case. It was a landmark case for us on racial profiling in Canada. And so I think he's taking some of what he learned from that experience and applying it more widely.
As a fellow attorney, have you had any experiences with racism as you've been practicing law?
Yeah, I would say, I've experienced some of that heightened suspicion when it comes to whether or not I am a lawyer. So there are certain spaces that, of course, lawyers can only have access to. And so if there is a security guard or if there is somebody attending to the door, they become hyper aware of me because they're usually comfortable or only experiencing white people walk through those spaces. And so I'll get questioned in very particular ways that I notice other people won't get. But for your listening audience, for added context, I've only been practicing 3 years. Not to say there is, like, by 5 years I should have a racial or anti-Black racist experience, but I've only just started my career, and I would be a fool if I thought that I'm not going to experience a lot of those things along the way. But so far, I haven't. In some of the overt ways that Sullivan Peters has, well, you know, I say I haven't. I haven't knowingly. So there may be ways in which I'm being cut out of opportunities, or ways in which I am being denied access to things that I don't know about. But that's part of what racism and white supremacy does. Sometimes you don't even know that you're being pulled out of certain things because of your race, but it's actually happening.
Mm. Very significant amendment there, Mr. Morgan. I agree completely. Are you familiar with the situation that came up within the last few weeks? They have a site that is marked Nigger Rock. It's a Quebec cemetery where enslaved Black people are buried, and Dan Phillip, he's the president of the Black Coalition of Quebec. He wants to leave the name as Nigger Rock, and he said that change it would be to be dishonest about the history of what Black people have experienced in Canada, how they were talked about, mistreated, the whole nine, and that it should remain Nigger Rock to make sure that context is preserved. What do you think about that stance?
To me, when I think about it, we have to engage the question of Black self-determination. So if the community, the Black community in Quebec, should decide that, you know what, this is part of how we identify, this is part of our heritage and the way we want to remember this space and the folks who passed away here, I think there's room to accept that. And I don't think it's for other people to challenge. That's one of the things we've been fighting for as African people since at least the 1400s, that ability to determine our own futures, to name ourselves, to characterize our own spaces. Now, of course, when you look at the name Nigger Rock, we didn't give it that name. That's what it was referred to by white people. But Black folks decided to take that up in a way that they, like, clearly in the way Dan Phillip is advocating. So if the community should decide, and so I'm presuming that the community is behind Mr. Phillip in that call, then I think you should go for it. But if the community is not, then that needs to be listened to. And whatever ways in which they want to re-identify the space, they should. But ultimately, whatever it's called, the determination should be by Black people who are connected to that space. So the Black Quebecers who are there, and Quebec has its very own particular kind of history within the history of Canada. And so that needs to be valued and appreciated, whatever they decide to do, ultimately, in terms of what their position is, keeping the name or removing the name. But of course, that brings up the larger debate about the N-word itself, the nigger, right? So would I take the same position that because young people use it as a term of endearment, we should definitely go with it? Again, I think this is something, it's an ongoing debate. It's an ongoing conversation that I don't think is as clear cut as you have this as this historical site. That's giving an answer without giving an actual answer. That's how lawyers do.
Well done. Well done. Anthony Morgan. If we had people that dialed in, I think even some of our Canadian listeners, so I wanted to get our callers, but I couldn't. Before I do that, I had to ask at least two questions about former Mayor Rob Ford. You've written about him. I know we talked about earlier this year that when he died, that was kind of in the middle of a lot of the Black Lives Matter Toronto protesting around Andrew Locu's shooting death and getting information about the police shooting. And some people felt that that kind of diverted attention from what was happening with the Black Lives Matter Toronto group. Did you get a sense that Black people in Canada, Black Canadians, did you get a sense that they were, you know, especially grieved about Rod Ford, or did they not care too much? Like, what was your observation of that?
I can't speak as a, like, in a representative way, but I will say that from what I saw, there wasn't a whole lot of grieving around his passing. I know when he was alive, people had an affinity to him. He had an unusual lore for Black people, but when he passed away, and again, I'm not saying it didn't happen. I just didn't see like tremendous grief or a sense of loss generally within the community. But I also leave it open to other people to say, yeah, like the Black people were devastated by this loss. But I certainly didn't get that impression. He was a very large man. He also, we know he engaged in smoking crack and other unhealthy behaviors. So what I actually saw were folks sort of shrugged it off in the Black community and be like, that's sort of what happens when you live that life. This is how you go. And then on to the next kind of.
Hmm. Right on. Did you wrote about Mr. Ford and saying, does Toronto Mayor Rob Ford have a white savior complex because of his efforts with some of these local Black sports clubs and, you know, saying, hey, I'm the only hope that these young children have, kind of paraphrasing some remarks that his brother made. Do you stand by that as well from, I think this was 2013, so do you stand by that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that he definitely exhibited some of that white savior complex. He would talk about these kids have nothing. And so the programs that he created were to give these kids something, to give them reason to live, essentially. And so if you look at, so he sponsored a football program and he coached football within one of the most impoverished areas that has a heavy population of Black folks. And he would often do these very problematic photo ops with young Black males who would give testimonies about how great he is. And because he's wealthy and his family has been historically connected politically, he can always get that media attention to show that. So he likes to project himself as that. And so, yes, he's passed away, and we have to have respect for the dead is what we say. But I definitely stand by those comments that he definitely, by his own, how he spoke about Black people, Black youth, and the things he did, he certainly had a white savior's complex, in my estimation.
Mm. We will nab a few of our callers. I think this is actually one of our Canadian listeners who suggested you. He was a big fan of your work, thought it would be great to have you on the program. Our caller in Canada, did you have any questions for Mr. Morgan?
Hey, Gus. Hey, Mr. Morgan. Appreciate you being on the show. I do have, I think... Pardon?
You can call me Anthony.
Okay, Anthony. Okay. I think I have... Let me just quickly... Okay, you answered the stats. Okay, actually, I have a question about the stats issue because right now I going to school in the U.S., but I've lived in Toronto pretty much 99.9% of my life. And, you know, one of the things my relatives bring up, oh, it's worse there with police violence and blah, blah, blah. And I remember in a talk, I don't remember what station you were on, and you brought up some of what you were saying that when you factor in population difference. So regarding the use of lethal force by the Toronto police force, how did that compare to, I guess, other comparable U.S. police forces? Did you ever get to that point, or maybe I misheard you?
Well, yeah. Well, it started to creep eerily close when we see what the numbers are in terms of overrepresentation. But, of course, there's so many major cities in the state using Toronto, for one, is not the best comparator with all those states. But there's an article that myself and Professor Akwasi Owusu-Bempah jointly published in the Globe and Mail, of course, one of our two national newspapers that looks more closely at that. So I couldn't cite the numbers for you off the top, and I don't have them official. And that's part of the anti-blackness, of course, that manifests within Canada. They will never be official because the government refuses to collect the information. And so we have to make approximations using sophisticated systems of putting that information together, but it's not official data at that point. So you can check out that article, myself and Akwasi Owusu-Bempah, and we talk about the troubling truths in terms of the connections between policing in Canada and the U.S. when you look at specifically use of lethal force.
Okay, thank you for that. That's a very important. Thank you so much. Now, for my second question, now I don't know if you're familiar with Canadian children's science fiction writer Zeta Elliott. She's in the U.S. and she wrote an article, "Does Canada Damage Black People?" And one of the things she mentioned is that because she decided to, you know, similar to me, go to the U.S. because, as you know, people in Canada don't like to talk about the R word. And I noticed this difference being in school here. It's a huge difference. UFT, for example, doesn't even want to have mandatory courses on racism. I'm at Temple University, and they're required to take courses on racism, just to illustrate some of the differences. It's been pretty dramatic for me, and I know you probably follow. Do you follow Rochelle DeCoste?
Yeah.
Yep, she talks about it as well. She jumps. So she talks about these things, but with Zeta, she really specifies that, you know, it wasn't just, you know, people who are racist, but how black people see Canada, especially in Toronto. How much do you think the media has on confusing black people in Toronto? Because I find, in my view, that I think all black people are confused about this system, for systematically imposed for a number of reasons. But I think on a scale of 1 to 10, I think black people in Canada are way more confused than in the U.S. I think in the U.S. it's like 6. I think in Canada, Toronto specifically, I think it's like 9.5. That's my view. How do you think media amplifies this confusion? Because it's very hard, I find, even for black people to see Toronto as having a race problem with racism.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of media distortion about conversations on race, and the media participates in that actively. If you look at our media, it's extremely white. Even the reporter, if you look at the staff writer, the columnist, the head folks at, for instance, the Toronto Star, terrible at the National Post, terrible at the Globe and Mail. So those are probably a few of our biggest papers. Easily, and it's overwhelmingly white, and not to say that whiteness necessitates that incompetence, but these people have little to no actual training or understanding, or have no demonstrated training or understanding in issues of race, and so that impacts our entire population. So that's on the print front, but of course in broadcast media too, it is overwhelmingly white, even if it's not the people in front of you who are reading the news. The people who are writing the news that they're reading are often white, and they have these white sensibilities about the issues. And so it plays a huge role in distorting our conversations. But I wouldn't just put it at the media's foot. If we look at education systems, the people who are trained to cultivate our young people to survive in this world don't have the tools to do that for black folks. They're not trained in the ways racism impacts young people or how it will impact them as they go through their education and try to get jobs and try to start families. And so it's a multi-systemic failing across Canada because of, again, that national investment that we have, that Canadian racial exceptionalism across the board, that we don't have a race problem. And so I think that's where, I agree with you, that's where a lot of that confusion comes from. And the media plays a huge role, but so do other systems.
That answered your questions, caller in Canada? Not.
Yeah, if I could say more, or did you want to move to another caller?
I was going to go to the next caller, but if you, had a final sentence you wanted to make sure you got in, feel free.
Yeah. Just one thing. So I have an older sister. Her name is Toni Morgan, and she had her story sort of went viral about a year and a half ago. She was homeless for a time, and she ended up at Harvard. So she completed her studies at Harvard just a few months ago. But in her being at Harvard doing a master's of education, we would have this conversation all the time about the ways in which there's this level of comfort, relative comfort or ease or familiarity with issues of race in the States versus, of course, here in Canada. She was always shocked but she actually welcomed it, that there was a freshness. Even if folks were white supremacists, it would be right there, out there, in your face. But in Canada, we are so mum and hush about it. There's one of our great writers and poets, George Eliot Clarke. I read a piece in a book that was published just a couple of months ago, where he likens Canadian racism, and I apologize if this is too crude, but he likens it to a silent fart. Canadian racism is like a silent fart, where you don't know where exactly it comes from. Everyone smells it. Everyone knows it's there, but we posture and play like it wasn't someone amongst us, but it clearly was, right? And so you compare that to more the overt racism. He didn't go further. He didn't develop the analogy further. It was a tongue-in-cheek thing, but I think it's sort of appropriate when you think about, if you understand Canadian racism, if you've ever spent some time here and hear about the bizarre ways we talk about race, it does look like that reaction when someone does that in a space.
Wow. On a program where we highlight the significance of metaphors. Wow. That is historic, Mr. Morgan. That is one for the records.
Well, I can't take credit for it. Like I said, that's George Eliot Clarke.
Amazing. Amazing. That is definitely going on the highlight reel. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Mr. Anthony Morgan?
Yes, I did. I had a question, and thank you for coming on the show, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Okay, yes, and thank you for taking my call, Gus. My question is, when I hear white privilege, I generally invoke, and just going by the definition that most white people use, it has to do with them being ignorant about the system of racism, white supremacy, about the actions that they do. Do you think that white people are ignorant about the actions that they do, when racist actions that they impose on black people?
Not always, no. I think there are many times in which they know exactly what they're doing. They know that they are harming, if not a black person, some other racialized person, whether they be South Asian or indigenous or Asian. I think there are definitely instances where they know, but there are also a lot of instances where they don't know. And those incidents where they don't know, they often don't know because they're trained not to know. They're trained to not have to know. And to me, that's where
give me an example of one of those instances where you think a white person doesn't know they're being racist?
An instance where a person doesn't know. So one that might not even be the best. It might not even be the best example, but the one that's coming to mind right now is there is a golf country club in Canada recently that had a celebration of island festivities. So what some of the folks did who attended this, and again, sorry to give more context, it's a very white country club, and as far as I know, no black people were there. It's all white folks. And so part of this island-themed party featured these dreadlock Jamaican hats that folks were parading around in, white people taking pictures in these dreadlock hats, smiling and having fun. Now, I think there are some people who know that this is a problem, but my honest feeling, and I'm totally open to being proven wrong, that's an instance where a lot of these people are just plain ignorant. But again, they're allowed to be ignorant because they're constructed to never have to really have conversations about why it's problematic to represent this whole dreadlock Jamaican look, that if an actual black person does it, they could be stigmatized, arrested, shot and killed by police because of constructions of fear around that, and not just fear, but criminality around that, whereas white people can see it as a time for celebration and having fun with. So those are, I would say that's only one example that I think of out of a concrete instance that happened recently in Canada. So there are times, I would also argue that there are people who don't know that blackface itself comes from a racist history. They've just seen this projection so long. They don't understand that it has a context, a particularly violent and racist context when it comes to black people. And so they go in Halloween costumes with blackface. It doesn't mean it's less of a problem. It just means there's a different way of engaging that person. So a person who intentionally knows that this is racist and does it, you have to handle that person differently from the person who has no idea about this context. Right? I think that's why it's important to make those distinctions. How you respond is critical.
Wow. Well, that thanks for those examples, man. Country Club, man, that's a major, major act of racism just for them to even have a Halloween party to start with. I mean, so they already knew they were going to go in there with their dreadlocks, and they probably forgot their black paint. I only ask because I've done a lot of contemplating and using logic, and I don't see any instances where white people are ignorant at all to any of the actions they do against black people because they know they're white and they know the situation. But thank you for answering my questions, Gus. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas in New York. I was going to say just a golf club in and of itself. Forget the island theme party and anything else. Just a golf club that probably doesn't have any black people except porters or custodians.
Yeah.
That in and of itself is pretty plantational, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
I could be in error. And in my opinion, they know that they don't have any black people. I think there's some difference.
Oh, I think they definitely know that. They definitely know that.
Right on. Roz, the article I found that was referenced, it's titled "A Hard Truth, Canada's Policing Style is Very Similar to the U.S. From the Globe and Mail. I posted it on our Facebook page. You should check it out, where he's comparing policing in Toronto to what it looks like in the United States. He was a co-author. Roz, did you have a question for Mr. Morgan? You should be with us.
Yes. Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you so much. Greetings to you, Gus, and greetings to you, Mr. Morgan. I thank you very much for being on the show this evening. I had two questions. The first one is there any sort of Pan-African movement in Canada, or are black people in Canada essentially separated by the countries that they came from originally? And if there is a Pan-African movement in Canada, what does that look like?
Sure. So we don't have a strong Pan-African movement, if I'm being really honest. One of the folks, so there are definitely Pan-Africanists who are doing some of the community organizing and mobilization in Canada, but an actual movement, a Pan-African movement, we've haven't been strong on that level of consciousness and activism here in Canada. One brother who was really leading that force, and he's a PhD, but always, forever was grounded in the people. His name is Dr. Ajamu Nangwea. So Ajamu, last name Nangwea. Dr. Ajamu Nangwea, he was based in Toronto, and he was the leading force around continuing to push that Pan-Africanist consciousness and bridge some of those connections between the continent, the Caribbean, Canadian experiences, North American experiences, and the entire Western Hemisphere of that, and wherever blackness is finds itself expressed. But we actually recently, he took a position at the University of West Indies in Jamaica about 2 months ago. So he's there now, and there are folks who were organizing with him continue to do some of that work, but it's really small scale at this point right now. And so there is an organization, I'll probably have to send it afterward, the name of which is escaping me, but I think it's escaping me. It's sort of indicative that it's not at the forefront of my mind because of how small the movement is, unfortunately. And that's not a fault to them. I think it's just a function of where we find ourselves in the development of our consciousness as a people here. There is some of that island stuff that happened, I would say historically, what folks refer to as tribalism. So folks from Jamaica not agreeing so much with folks from Trinidad, not agreeing with folks from Haiti, and all that being an issue. But most of that has largely gone away because young people here, so folks, I think, maybe 30, maybe even 40 and younger, mostly born in Canada. And so we don't have that kind of cleaving to island identities as much as we did with the generation just over us, that was a huge thing and caused a lot of breakdown within community mobilization.
Thank you. And you just actually made me think of another question. What do you think, or why do you think there's such a stark difference between the way, I guess, Black people think in the U.S. As far as the experience of racism, white supremacy here, versus the way Black people tend to think in Canada? Because it seems to be different, though Canada is so close to the United States. I would have thought that maybe some of that revolutionary consciousness might have bled across the border, but it doesn't seem like that's the case. Do you think that whites were more successful at psychologically isolating the Black people that they had cordoned off in the Northern Hemisphere in Canada, so that there wasn't much of a connection between them and the Blacks in the United States, who had, I would say, probably more of a Pan-African consciousness as far as just the types of Black leaders and revolutionaries that we had in the States?
I think that's definitely a part of it. I think there's a level of comfort that Black folks in the States were in some ways allowed to grow into, because there was a historic recognition of the population there. And so thinking through who you were as a Black person and the sufferings of Black people, I think, because the presence is more long-term and more widespread in the States, you had that. But here, while there are definitely, as I mentioned earlier on in the program, Black folks who've been here since at least the 1600s, mostly were here from the Caribbean, from the I would say the 60s, 70s, not I would say, but statistically 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so we are still growing into that identity of who we are in this space. We're still not solid in that. And so I think because we're trying to work through that, in some ways it's hindered our ability to think more globally about our connection to Blackness in other spaces. But all of this comes with a very serious caveat that we did have some very strong Black Pan-Africanists here that were leading movements and cultivated Pan-Africanism here. So a little known fact, folks in the program might already know this, but the parents of Malcolm X actually met in Montreal, Canada. And at a Garveyite movement, the UNIA was having a meeting. Malcolm X's mom, her name is Stacey right now, but she hailed from the Caribbean island of Grenada, but was in Montreal, met the father of Malcolm X, Malcolm Little. And so that space was there. We also have, fast forward into the early 90s, Dudley Laws, who's anybody who follows Black activism or values that Black activism within Canada would know Dudley Laws. Dudley Laws was a huge Garveyite. He led a lot of the protests and activism for the upliftment and advancement of Black people within Canada, and he passed away a few years ago. You have Dr. Akua Benjamin, who is now a professor at one of the universities in Toronto. She, definitely strong Black Pan-Africanist consciousness and leading the way, supporting in the background, but because she's definitely a more senior community member, and I say that in the most loving way possible, but she was doing a lot of the work on the ground in the early 90s, and now is in the university bringing some of those ideas to do that activism work there, but staying connected in community. So all that to say that we do have that tradition here, and there's some of our major forces have come from a Pan-Africanist consciousness. It's just collectively we haven't taken it up as a community as strongly as I think we'd like.
Okay. And also, how do Canadians view Blackness as far as the way white people do? Do they have anything similar to like the one drop rule like they had in the United States, or is it like a different, I guess, color coded system that they use as far as the white people in Canada and how they view Blackness?
All the questions I've gotten are really good. These are very good questions in particular, so I appreciate you asking. How do they view it? I think there is, I would say we definitely still ascribe to the kind of one drop rule. But it's less a question of blood than it is of borders here. So within the states around blackness, there is this fixation and fascination with blood, as in like how black are you? Like, are you 1/8? Are you octoroon? Like, what are you? Right? Are you a quarter? Are you half? Whereas for us, as long as you don't look white, the presumption is you're from another space. So that's why I say it's more about borders than blood here. So then there would be the presumption that, oh, you're a foreigner, or where are you? A person cannot place you. So we have this obsession in Canada when it comes to race with belonging and otherness that revolves more around borders and less around blood. And so the question, when folks look at a person who's non-white, there's always this presumption that you're born elsewhere, or at least your parents were born elsewhere, and you have all these exotic things about yourself, and you're not just quote unquote just Canadian.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. My final question is: what do you think that Black Canadians have a holistic understanding of racism, white supremacy, or do you think that white Canadians have successfully obfuscated Black people's ability to really understand the intricacies of how white people function as, I would say, like a racist superorganism, where they all function collectively the same way. Some might be more refined in their practice of racism, so you might think of them as quote-unquote less racist versus the overtly racist. So I just wanted to know if there was, like, any sort of holistic understanding of white people in the way in which the average black person would distrust them and suspect them of practicing racism, even if they treated them, let's say, nice or whatever the case may be, in a nice way. Or do you think there's more confusion?
I think folks could call it confusion, but I think I lean more towards just there's a diversity of understandings of racism. I think generally speaking, because Canada is so hesitant to talk about racism, it even affects black people's own understandings and where they are where we are in our collective development, and appreciations of the multi-level nature, from the direct to the systemic to the symbolic manifestations of racism. So I don't think we're at a place, to answer your question directly, where we have a collective understanding of this system of white supremacy and anti-black racism. There are some black folks who still will defend blackface. There's still black folks who I've seen, unfortunately, who will say that the killings of Andrew Locu, Jermaine Carby, Kwasi Skeen-Peters is another person killed by police, Abdi Rahman, we don't know enough about the facts. It wasn't about race. Or they will disparage Black Lives Matter as a movement because they don't understand what they're doing in Canada, and say that's an American phenomenon that we've imported here for issues that we don't have. All of that is to say that I think there's a diversity and a range of opinion on that. And I think it speaks to, it was embedded in your question, sort of the obfuscation that happens, or the impediment, the impedes, or the obstacles that have been put in front of us collectively across Canada, not just black folks, but across the way in actually having real, honest, in-depth, and I think good faith conversations around what racism is, who it impacts, and how it impacts us.
Thank you so much for answering my questions, and thank you for taking my call, Gus. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Person who dialed in 4243, did you have a question for Anthony Morgan?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, because I've been trying to keep up a lot more with the 13th Amendment and also just watching more documentaries about mass incarceration, or Scotty Reed would say 21st century slavery. Do you have any knowledge of you seeing that the Canadian prison system kind of imitating or wanting to morph into what we have here in the States?
Uh,
Hello? Did you finish your question, yes. caller?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
That was it. I was saying, do you see any mirroring between what we've seen here in the States as far as mass incarceration and in Canada? So I understand that, of course, with the drug war that exploded the prison population. Does the lawyer see anything, Mr. Moore, do you see anything kind of resembling that in Canada?
Yeah, absolutely. So the same article that was referenced that I wrote with Kwasi Dexter, Kwasi Lusubempa, shows that. So we had and are continuing to have our own war on drugs within Canada, and it's led to a large explosion of the black population within our prisons. But again, because we don't have the same scale, folks aren't talking about it as much. But one of the areas in Canada where you do have the best official statistics on where black people are is in our prisons, in our federal prisons. And so I can say confidently within the last 10 years, there has been, for instance, an increase in the black population, the black population specifically within the prisons, of 70%. And 2 years ago, so 2004 to 2014, that increase was 90%. And so you have this huge acceleration of the black population within prisons because you have this targeted policing of black folks. Back in 1996, there was this Commission on Systemic Racism in the Criminal Justice System that was launched within Ontario. So the government finally listened to community activists that said, you're targeting our population, that's leading to hyper-incarceration. And so back in 1996, they found that from, I think it was 1985 to 1995, the population of black folks who were incarcerated for drugs had jumped by more than 1,000%. I think it was 1,100% just from 85 to 94. And so we have this targeting of black folks that is leading to over-incarceration. So whereas in the States you talk about mass incarceration, because of course across the world you have the most people incarcerated, the highest incarceration rate across the world. So because Canada is a smaller country, we don't situate it in the context of mass incarceration. We talk about over-incarceration. So when you look at black people, when you look at Native Americans or Indigenous people, they are dramatically over-incarcerated, but we don't have a mass incarceration problem, if you understand where I'm going with that.
Oh, yes, thank you. And then the last question I have, it's actually just goes along with the first part. Do you know if the prisons there, if the inmates, if they have to work for private companies and providing services or making things actually generating wealth for private entities?
At this point, as far as I know, it's not widespread. I will say, honestly, because of the work that I do, I'm usually more on the outside. I'll definitely visit folks on the inside. I've had clients on the inside, but knowing the intricacies, to say absolutely no, there's none of that for-profit work that's being done for these big corporations, I can't say that confidently. But as far as I know, I can't say that it's not happening for certain, but I don't know of any instance where that is happening. There are definitely inmates who do work in the prison for their canteen money and so on and so forth, but I don't know if there's that connection in the same way we see it within the States. But there's been a lot of mobilization and activism around preventing the privatization of prisons. So whereas private prisons is a huge deal in the U.S., while we have them in Canada, it's on a much smaller scale. It's not as intense where you have full-blown for-profit corporations running our major institutions. It's still largely, like many of our public institutions, or like many institutions like that, I should say, still publicly run, and you don't have the influence of the private corporations as intensely. But of course, it's private corporations that are making the clothes, that are providing electricity, that is making food, and so there's still a profiteering element to it. But in terms of using inmate labor for the advancement of capitalistic interests, I don't know that that's widespread the case in the way we see it in the States.
Very well, thank you. That's all I had.
Appreciate that. Retired firefighter in Florida, did you have a question for Mr. Morgan? You should be with us.
Yes, sir. Greetings, everyone, and to the guests. Hopefully, I am on topic or within the realms of the topic, but it is a curiosity of mine. From my knowledge, Canada, the place that's called Canada, they share some things in similarity to white people in this part of the world as far as some of the things that they hold as symbols. They're kind of serious about these symbols that they have, like flags and statues and songs, and they share that. Matter of fact, they share the colors of the flag, that sort of thing. I was just wondering, because I'm pretty sure you know about Colin Kaepernick. He's the latest of non-white figures of some sort of well-known status that has deliberately used in a symbolic way against the symbols of white supremacy. Are there any examples of that you know of in the place that's called Canada?
I have to say that I don't know off the top of my head. Again, not to say that it's not happening, but mm-hmm. I can't think of any stances similar to Kaepernick's at this point right now. Maybe it'll come to me, but again, I think that has a lot to do with how Canada is invested in seeing itself as a place without race or a place without issues of race. So. I think even activist folks, they're now waking up to the possibility of using symbols that we have in Canada, like the beaver, or using beer, or using our national anthem, or using hockey, these kinds of things to disturb some of our comfortable notions about a place of racial harmony. But I don't know right now. Maybe there's some examples within the Indigenous community. So again, folks in the States might refer to Native Americans. So the Indigenous community, there's a huge tide of organizing widespread activism to have a lot of their rights to land, to well-being, literally to water itself that is going on. And so you might see some things there, but I can't think of one off the top of my mind that is close. But you know what? Mm. One is slowly coming to me, actually. So so in Canada, we still have the monarchy. So we still have the Queen of England, and that whole monarchy is actually in law, the Queen and the royal family of Canada. So that's embedded within our legal institutions and customs. So maybe the closest thing is, so the royal family, so I think it's Prince William and Will and Kate, yeah, they visited they recently visited, and they were supposed to have a meeting with the royals. Sorry, the royals were supposed to have a meeting with some Indigenous or Native American chiefs here. And some of the chiefs said, no, this is ridiculous symbolism, right? And that caused a minor scandal because
right on.
Canada has this investment, again, in the monarchy and seeing ourselves as connected to this great tradition. But these Indigenous chiefs were like, forget that, give us our land back. I'm not gonna meet
right
you for a photo op. Like, don't disrespect us, because we're still fighting for the right to live in many spaces across Canada. So yeah, as I speak, that probably is the strongest one that has happened most recently. But in terms of Black folks, I don't know, but I think we as Black folks should take an example from what we saw with those Indigenous chiefs standing up and saying, we won't be used in this way.
I can join add a quick response on this one. The Toronto Raptors, the basketball team up there, the preseason just started. They did
form a protest during one of their recent preseason games. This was just within the last few days. They said that the Raptors, I'm just reading from the Huffington Post Canada, Raptors said earlier this week that they plan to join the growing chorus of pro athletes speaking out against police brutality and racial injustices in the United States. The NBA has a rule that players and coaches must stand during the national anthem, although that rule wasn't mentioned in a recent letter to players. So they locked arms as opposed to kneeling while the anthem played.
May I add to that, though, why that is interesting? So, I actually forgot about that example. It's an important one, and it should be supported. But if you look at it again, they're protesting violence in the States. But if we think about Andrew Loku, we think about Abdi Rahman Abdi, if we think about Jermaine Carby, Kwasi Steen-Peters, again, Eric Osawe, there's a list of names in Canada, folks who've been suffering police violence, who've been killed by police, and the police have gone off with, so far, immunity. That it's troubling that even still you'd have the Toronto Raptors, who, as far as I know, are not connecting it to experiences that happen right up the road from where they play their home game.
Yeah, like I figured, because basically, in that part of the world was imploded and terrorized by basically the same white people who are calling themselves French, as well as white people call themselves English. And I can remember elementary school wise that we shared the same song. It just changed the words that I think is the quote unquote Canadian national anthem. So I know there's a lot of similarities in these terroristic, these celebratory terroristic symbols that they have done, you know, kind of like poking fun at non-white people that they have ridiculed and terrorized. And they really get angry, it seems like it anyway, when non-white people are aware of this terror and just turn away from these symbols that they have. And that's just my observation. I was wondering if it was some similarities, but thanks for the discourse.
Appreciate that. The caller at 2899, did you have a question for Mr. Morgan?
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Doc, or sir. Only question I have for you is, do you believe that there is a disconnection between people of color or melanated people is there a disconnect between American black people and other foreign black people, and I don't even want to say foreign, but black people that have been indigenous to their home? Is there a disconnect there in our language and how we understand racism? Because I heard earlier how Russ gave you the rundown of his definition, and one word stood out to you that made me realize that there must be a disconnect. How do you feel about this, sir?
Yeah, I think we have different understandings, or we're at different places in our understanding, I will say, when it comes to who we are as a people. I think there's, of course, the concept of hegemony, right? So, like, this large influence that the United States has across the world, but also in a way in which it centralizes pretty much everything that it is, and one of those things, and I don't mean this in any kind of disrespectful way, but even Black Americanism or folks, African Americans or Black folks in the U.S. Are, in many ways, are toted across the world or seen across the world as the measure of Blackness. And so where I think those different understandings come from is that there are complex ways in which Blackness is lived in the UK and in England, of course, on the continent itself, within Canada, within the Caribbean. But because we don't have the same global geopolitical force and influence, and our media certainly isn't as strong, and I'm not just speaking about Canada, but across the world, and geopolitically we don't feature these other countries like the United States does, I think it creates different understandings of Blackness and like that I think does result in different conversations and different reasonings through who we are in the space and how we relate to each other.
I agree, because I realize Gus does a good job at hearing things that even I would say I don't think the average person could hear that comes that he's able to bring forth. So I agree with you there, and I appreciate your answer. So let me ask this last question, and I'll mute my line. You spoke of something that I would call pedigree, and it means, you know, in America, the one drop rule. Yeah. And you spoke about it in Canada. I think what I'm hearing is that in America, the one drop rule is simply, if you've even been tainted by a person of color, you're black, period. And that could be the most diluted version of colored person, as far as I'm concerned. How does that work in Canada?
So if we think about it, I would say if you have any of that indication that instead of it being black, if you're non-white, you're not Canadian. So just off in some way, like your whether it be your hue or maybe one of your features or the texture of your hair, then almost immediately the assumption is, yeah, this person's not born here. Their heritage comes from elsewhere. Even though, again, we have long-standing populations in southern Ontario, so a few hours south of Toronto, right up to Nova Scotia, where those Shelburne riots initially happened. Black folks who've been here much longer than many, arguably, in some cases, most of the white people here. But still, there is this questioning and this idea that if you're not white, so if you're non-white, and especially if you're black, then you couldn't also be Canadian. The concepts are mutually exclusive. And so instead of, so in the States, it's one drop, then you are black. Then it's, if it's one drop of non-whiteness, then you must not be Canadian.
Okay. Now, my last question, I'll move along, Gus, is that knowing that information as a lawyer or an attorney, how do you practice law when you have to take on a person of color or a non-white person? And that's, I'll mute my line.
It really depends on the case itself, and it depends on whether or not race is a factor, which it often is, and then how it is a factor. And then thinking through, based on the information that's presented to me or evidence that's shared, how I can use that to construct an argument about the presence of anti-blackness. So I like to remain on top of research and writing on different complex ways of understanding blackness, and also law in the States, law in Canada, on what arguments have been successful. And a situation, for instance, that might not quote unquote look obviously racist, but if you look at the psychology, if you look at the trends, if you look at the patterns, you can make the argument that there's an element of race here. So that's how I manage that. But it really is a case-by-case assessment based on what I get in front of me.
Appreciate that. Caller, the last two people that dialed in, the caller at 5771, 5771, did you have a question for Anthony Morgan?
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, Mr. Morgan. I've got two questions. Here in the States, racism, white supremacy has decimated the public school system in regards to legalized segregation, school prison pipeline. How is the education in Canada about the same, or is it, you know, something more different, more refined in regards to public school system?
No, we definitely have our own school to prison pipeline that's operationalized here in Canada. Wherever there's a substantial population of black folks, you do have that pipeline. So on the education front, you still have the criminalization of our kids, female and male. If you look at suspensions and expulsion rates, the only school board that actually collects the data officially is Canada's largest school board, which is the Toronto District School Board. And in their own numbers, they show the dramatic overrepresentation in suspensions and expulsions. So we have that And of course, young people statistically who find themselves suspended and expelled have a higher chance of getting in the prison system. And then I didn't mention this earlier, but the population of Black folks within our prison system, our federal system, for the most serious offenses, they're overwhelmingly under the age of 30. I think it's been a while since I've visited the stat, but I think it's almost 80% are under 30, between 60 and 80. It's a significant number regardless, but the point remains that, yes, we have the same issues in education. When it comes to funding or resourcing, it's terrible. We can't get resources that affirm the identities of our Black students, and so we have high dropout rates. We also have the system that we call streaming, so diverting our young people into less academically challenging areas without actually assessing if it's appropriate for them. It's just making a pretty much a very loose judgment. You're Black, you're male often, and so we're going to stream you into this line that prevents you from being able to get access to college and university or even graduate from high school at level. And so we have those challenges also, and it relates to the representation within our schools. So we have very few racialized or Black teachers, or even teachers who understand Black experience. And it's creating a lot of challenges for our students. We have the closest thing we have as a state response is what we call an Afrocentric school. There are two Afrocentric schools and numerous Afrocentric programs in Toronto, but it's and some in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and in the province of Nova Scotia. But the ones in Nova Scotia are much more community-based, but the ones in Toronto, they have positives and negatives to them. Anytime you give something over to the state that is about Black people, you will have positives and negatives, but there is an institutional response to try to address some of those dropout rates and the high suspension rates and low achievement that results from anti-Black racism in education.
Okay. One last thing. I was in my education growing up, I was always told that slavery didn't exist in Canada, which we all is not true. I read a book called The Hanging of Angelique by Afua Cooper, and yes. It was a very insightful book about Canadian slavery, and didn't seem too different from, you know, American slavery. Can you recommend any books or texts or anything documenting, you know, specifically Canadian slavery?
Canadian slavery. So there is this book by a professor named Marcel Trudel, M-A-R-C-E-L-T-R-U-D-E-L, and it's called Canada's Forgotten Slaves. It's a pretty obvious title to get a sense of the depth and breadth of slavery within Canada. So I'd say that's an important text to look to. I would say also Robin Winks' The Blacks in Canada. That book is from the 70s, though. Some really good research is in there, but I think that's a good place to go. I'll leave you with those for now, but the go-tos for many folks is Marcel Trudel and almost anything from Dr. Afua Cooper in that respect.
Okay, thank you, sir. I'll mute my line.
Afua Cooper, guest on the program this past summer. I read her book as well. We discussed that on the program, The Hanging of Angelique. And I can recommend, since we had a number of different folks on from Canada over the summer, North to Bondage, Loyalist Slavery in the Maritimes. This came out over the summer. Harvey Amani Whitfield. You can check that one out, too. The caller, last caller, at 7722, last four digits, 7722. Did you have a question for Anthony Morgan?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Lamine and KC. Greetings, Mr. Morgan. Greetings, Mr. Renegade. I have a question regarding yesterday's program was about the continued white terror of Black female in a U.S. state who recently decriminalized recreational marijuana use. Given how there's an unproportional number of non-whites represented in the Canadian prison system, how do you think the decriminalization of marijuana will affect non-white people or possibly be used by white supremacists to harm? non-white people in Canada.
So how would decriminalization be used to harm essentially black folks?
Yes, sir.
It's a good question. I haven't really taken the opportunity to think about it in depth. What I have thought about, though, is what I imagine happening is just a shift of attention. Right now, drugs is used, or possession of drugs, sometimes use, but more often possession, is used as an excuse to accost or harass black people by police. But because a lot of the damage has already been done through the criminalization of black folks, historically, I think what may happen is that those records will not be wiped. The records of engagement with police will not be for possessing drugs will not be removed from the system. And so I imagine that police officers will use another excuse to say, hey, we just want to make sure you're not under any conditions. You're not under any bail conditions or release conditions. And so that's why we're checking you out. So while decriminalization isn't here yet, it's often a question of possession. We want to make sure you don't have anything on you. Once that does happen, I think the excuse will move to, we want to make sure you're not under any conditions. But those conditions will have come out of charges in the past for something that is now decriminalized. But beyond that, I'll be honest, I haven't thought through what specifically will happen. But you do see, of course, the racialized ways in which white folks are moving into that area of business, and they are going to be very profitable for them, whereas you have the continued criminalization of us as a people. What you might see also is a stratification, or like a different organization of labor. So we might, because if we're thinking about it, a lot of black folks are seen as wrongly as like the, in a way, stereotypical consumer of weed, for instance, is one particular drug, or marijuana. And so they may get a bunch of front desk jobs, but in terms of owning some of those marijuana dispensaries or owning some of those companies, we won't be there. But because there's this weird construction of blackness and its proximity to drugs, we might be there selling it and like finally get jobs within those spaces, but they still will be at the bottom rung. They won't be in a position of ownership overwhelmingly because it's not constructed to benefit us.
Thanks. That answered that. I have one more question. You made mention in a reply to the caller from New York that the response to someone practicing racism depends on their level of understanding, concluding that there are some white people who are ignorant about their racist acts. How can a victim of racism or a non-white person know whether someone is feigning ignorance or actively deceiving a non-white person? Wouldn't it be logical to suspect all white people of practicing racism, white supremacy?
I don't think it's logical to assume that, because again, I think it's logical to assume that yes, they could be lying to you, and so you'd have to embed in some way both responses, or you'd have to embed the openness to engaging both responses of whether or not the person is ignorant or is actively engaging in a malicious act deliberately. So I don't think that negative presumption would necessarily help us. I'm open to being convinced otherwise, but I think it's more you try to have an honest, engaging moment with that person and like let them know, yo, this is not appropriate. This is why this is a problem. If they decide to feign ignorance, I like to think that we as a people are very sophisticated. We can point that stuff out real quick. Not always, but often. Then that should inform how you handle it. But presuming otherwise, I think we might lose some people we could have won over to the struggle to serve as folks in support of eliminating anti-black racist systems and anti-black racist operations within our society. But that's just me.
Thank you. I'll mute my call.
Appreciate that. Have you won over a significant number of white people to oppose anti-black racism, white supremacy?
I honestly wouldn't say I've won folks over, but in the organizing that I've been a part of and that I've seen I've seen some non-black people and some white people who have been willing to, and I know it's not the best of terms, but I would still use it, use their white privilege to benefit black folks. One example is, and you see this in the States too, and you saw this in the protests in the UK when I think it's Heathrow Airport, when they shut down, when Black Lives Matter shut down the airport. It wasn't black bodies that were lying on the runway. It was a lot of white bodies that did that. And so they were willing to use their white privilege, knowing that systems would respond to them. They wouldn't just gun them down in the street or think that they were terrorists because they were on the runway at the airport. They put their bodies on the line. Within Canada, what I've seen, so while it's not me winning over anybody, but just seeing in how the organizing is happening, I've seen a lot of white folks stand up and say, you know what, for this protest, we are going to form a line around the black folks. So we know that the police are not just going to run up and shoot you down in the same way if you're going to be blocking a road or if you're going to be occupying a police headquarters or you're going to be engaging in some act of civil disruption. And so I've definitely witnessed that, and I see their promise in it. All that said, though, I have no dreams or imaginations of these people being totally diverse or divested of white supremacy. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that they're totally saved people and they're clean and they are they totally get it. Those same people will have failings, and I've seen that too, where they will still say things that are showing that they haven't fully grown in their understandings of what white supremacy is or how they benefit from it. But that's not to say that they're not still at a place, and I've seen them be at a place where they're willing to say, oh, I recognize that this is a problem, that the police or institutions will respond to me differently because of my whiteness, so I'm going to stand in the way to create space for another black person. I've definitely seen that.
Oh, I have seen that as well, even further back than the last few years with the whole Black Lives Matter protests and what have you, even all the way back in the 60s and before when black people were protesting against racism, you would see whites out protesting with them. It's my conclusion that a individual classified as white can go do that, and then when they're done protesting, resume the practice of racism, white supremacy in a variety of ways, and use their participation in those moments to trick black people, non-white people, into thinking that they are not racist. So, yes.
Definitely, I agree that definitely happens too. I will definitely say I've seen that as well. The unfortunate reality is that is also a thing. So we got to be careful on all fronts.
For sure, for sure. Before we let you enjoy the rest of your evening, I wanted to ask our caller in Canada. He normally points this out. You talked and you've written about some of the limited number of Afrocentric high schools available for black people in Canada. Our caller in Canada frequently points out what he perceives to be a resistance when someone says, hey, black people in Canada, we should work together, we should have our own school or own efforts where it's just about us, where we're not seeking to include whites and other people, we're just going to have this be something for black Canadians, kind of an idea that, hey, that's what we should be trying to get away from. We should be inclusive of everybody. We don't just want it to be an exclusive black space. He says he sees a lot of that and thinks that it is counterproductive towards working against racism. Is that something that you see as well or not really?
Seeing what is counterproductive towards me against racism?
Or
like
just
our own school?
Are you seeing that in general, like this idea of, no, let's not have something be exclusively black, let's make sure we're inclusive of everyone? Do you see that as well?
Yeah, I definitely see that. That's an important. So I mentioned the Afrocentric school in Toronto, but that came with a lot of tumult. There was a lot of tension, and there still is around the school where many folks would say, oh, no, that's segregating, that's self-segregation. So I see that tension that operates within our own ability or attempts to move our community forward. It's an unfortunate reality. So after years of debate and struggle, finally the school is established. But the parents have to rise up against it. But there's still black folks who feel. And again, for us in Canada, that has a lot to do with wanting to belong and focusing on any particular race in Canada, and especially if it's not a white race, if it's black folks, that scene is fundamentally un-Canadian because what we do here is called multiculturalism. And so we literally have this policy and these laws of multiculturalism, which create
they allow us to create this illusion where all people of all different races are equal. We're at the same fundamental starting points. And yeah, while we are equal in principle and actual operation, access to opportunities, lifespans, life opportunities and such, we are not equal. But still, because that myth of multiculturalism is so strong, there's hesitation from a lot of Black folks to have Black-focused and Black-exclusive institutions because they know that in the broader context, it's seen as un-Canadian, and all many of us want to do is just to belong. But I would argue that the minute that Canada evolves to a point of recognizing that you can still belong as Canadian with Black-focused institutions, those same people will be running to establish Black-focused institutions because they want to belong. They want to have their equal shot at opportunities and create those same things for their kids and for their kids' kids or people who look like them in their broader community.
Wow. It has been a pleasure. Our guest for the evening, bilingual lawyer and prolific writer, Mr. Anthony Morgan. I linked to the article he mentioned during the program, A Hard Truth, Canada's Policing Style is Very Similar to the U.S. We also have a lot of the articles that he's authored at Huffington Post Canada linked in the description to the program. Real pleasure to have you on the broadcast. Be great to have you back on. I'm sure there unfortunately will be more incidents of anti-Black racism in Canada, so it'd be great to speak with you again to get your thoughts on some of those future incidents, Mr. Morgan.
Yeah, well, thank you again, Gus, for having me. I really appreciated speaking with you and, of course, your listeners. Everyone was great, and I look forward to the opportunity to being on in the future. If I could plug one last thing of work, if folks are interested in learning more about experiences of Blackness in Canada, I co-authored one report to the United Nations on Blackness in Canada. It's called Civil and Political Wrongs. You can Google that. If you just put in Blacks in Canada and civil and political wrongs, that was one document I co-authored for UN Shadow Report, for instance, about Blackness in Canada. And more recently in February 2016, so the first report was in June 2015. In February 2016, I presented parts of a report on Blackness in Canada called The Blackening Margins of Multiculturalism. And again, looking at Blackness in health, in education, child welfare, sort of an attempt to do sort of a sweeping general analysis in the limitations of a 60 or so page report. So if folks want to learn more about that, I had the opportunity to go to Geneva to present that a few months ago. I think it's a valuable resource for understanding what Black people are experiencing and seeing here on this side.
Oh, man, I hit my mute button. I just stated I'm going to see if I can get both of the links for the articles that you just mentioned so I can post them on our Facebook page and share them with listeners. Always enjoy having quality literature to learn more about racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Just restate, really, really enjoyed and learned a lot having you on the broadcast, Mr. Morgan. We will let you enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening. Thank you so much for speaking with us, and we will talk to you again soon.
Again, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Take care, sir.
Have a good evening.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy. Anthony Morgan, our guest live from Canada. Always great. As I've stated this for years, I always think it's important, informative, to be able to talk to Black people, really anybody, but particularly Black people that are in different parts of the world, just to see the similarities, to comparison contrast, as they say, about the global structure of white supremacy racism. We will be here again tomorrow. As I've stated, we have many days of consecutive programs. So if the cows is of some constructive value, just stay tuned. We'll be here every day for a while. Tomorrow, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Saturday with the compensatory call-in. Sunday, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. That is, you know, the early broadcast so we can include our listeners from different parts of the world. That'll be at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific this Sunday. This coming Monday, we will have a white woman. She's a professor. She wrote a very explicit article describing that historically white institutions, they deliberately exclude black professors. She had it published in the Washington Post just earlier this month. She'll be here next Monday. Next Tuesday, the book Blood at the Root, when we had Mr. Morgan, he talked about Shelbourne, racial cleansing, purging of black people from the area. Blood at the Root talks about this happening in the state of Georgia, Forsyth County. We talked about that area before, but he grew up there, and so he writes about that experience. Next Wednesday, so a week from today, Allison Manswell, she's a black female. She wrote a whole book, Listen In, about racism, workplace racism, and different problems that black people experience on the job, and even suggestions for things we can do to neutralize some of those problems. Again, next Thursday, workplace racism. The book club next Saturday, next Friday, excuse me, next Saturday, compensatory call-in, and then Charles Woods will be here next Sunday. Charles Woods, black male, talking about the history of white supremacy in entertainment. So regular broadcasts, just stay tuned in as we continue to stay active for October. There was one quick passage I was going to share. Mr. Anthony Morgan, he talked, just putting in context some of the history of white terrorism that has taken place in Canada, and he mentioned, I think we discussed it briefly during the program, the noose, or excuse me, it was a cross-burning incident that happened in Nova Scotia. This is in 2010, not ancient history, 2010, and in Canada. And he links to a piece that's at the Chronicle Herald. It's titled Nova Scotia Burning Part 1, where they kind of have an expose and give all of the details about this case. Where it's Shane Howe, H-O-W-E, and Michelle Lyon. So Shane Howe is a black male. Michelle Lyon, she is a white woman. So they're to get cowbell. So they're together, and so a cross is burned in their yard. They have children as well. And so they review the case, what happened, catching the white people responsible for this. And they describe in detail, just to share some of what's in the report. It reads, being a biracial couple, it was good, said Howe, who is black. We never had no problems with it until now. On February 24th, when the RCMP charged Nathan and Justin Rayburg, two brothers from the area and distant relatives of Lyon, strangers from around the world were unforgiving. Nathan Rayburg, 21, said he saw about 150 Facebook messages that said things such as, you guys are racist, or I'm going to kill you next time I see you on the streets, or I hope you get raped in jail. Those who knew the brothers insisted they weren't filled with racial hatred. Now, again, these two brothers burned a cross on a black male in a white woman's house, but insisted that they were not filled with racial hatred. Continuing, Nathan Rayburg has a biracial daughter and both have black friends. Can't be racist. Biracial daughter. I've had sex with a Negro, so I can't be a racist even though I burned a cross on someone's yard. The brothers themselves were adamant they were not racist, of course, but even Nathan Rayburg admitted that burning a cross on a black man's lawn was something a racist would do. For Howe and Lyon, the cross burning meant that they and their children, ages 2 to 17, were the targets of hate, and someone wanted them out of their community. This small town tragedy started with rumors that the brothers had herpes. By the Rayburg brothers' own admission, what followed was an act of drunken, drug-induced stupidity. I've heard that before. On the night leading to the cross burning, the brothers were partying with friends at their family's mobile home in Avondale, just minutes down Avondale Road by car from the Howe Lyon home. Someone brought a case of beer, and another person brought a 40-ounce of rum and some shooters. All I know is that the fridge was full of liquor, Nathan Rayburg said. I will just insert, some moron consistently states that one of the worst combinations in the universe is whites and alcohol. Continuing with the report, at the party, a young couple repeated the herpes rumors to the Rayburg brothers. Justin, 20, and his brother had always said the rumors, which they believed Howe and Lyon had started, were untrue. But the gossip had taken on a life of its own and somehow had been twisted to include Nathan's fiancée, Maria Mason, and the couple's baby. It was getting my brother really mad, said Justin Rayburg. A couple of days before the party, his brother, already seething about the months-old rumors, had built the cross they eventually would burn on Howe's lawn. Nathan Rayburg gathered some floorboards from the backyard, nailed them together, and showed it to some friends who all laughed. His mother told him to get rid of it. Instead, he tucked it under the deck and went inside. The two-meter cross was still there when the conversation at the party took a seriously ugly turn, and he decided to put a stop to the rumors. I had enough. I knew Shane was African-American, and I wanted to scare him. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted him to feel as much hate, as much pain and anger as I was. Fueled by liquor and drugs, he talked about burning the cross all night, pressuring his brother to help him drag it to the Howe Lyon home. Their stepfather, Daniel McComber, urged them not to do it. Justin Rayburg and his girlfriend, Alicia Caldwell, went to bed shortly before 11 p.m., but Nathan Rayburg kept at his brother, who agreed to help. Nathan Rayburg got the cross, and one of them siphoned enough gasoline out of Justin's dune buggy to fill a perfume bottle. They dragged the cross about 2.5 kilometers to the Howe Lyon house. When vehicles went by, Justin Rayburg threw the cross in the ditch. The brothers even had competitions to see who could carry it the longest. They stopped to catch their breath as they came up the hill before the house. They drank the last of their beer and ran toward the home. Lights were on in the house, so I said, "Keep down, stay quiet," Nathan Rayburg said. He did, and he passed me the cross. It wouldn't go into the frozen ground, but he saw a ring on the well on the front lawn and stuck it there. His brother poured the gas, and they lit it. I knew that instant. I was like, "What the hell are we doing?" Nathan Rayburg said. He heard a door open and the brothers ran. He fell on the pavement several times. No one inside the Howe Lyon home knew anything was wrong until the oldest child, Ashley Rayburg, a distant cousin of the brothers, spotted the flames. "When I first seen the fire, it scared me so bad," she wrote in her victim impact statement to the court. "I didn't know what was going on, and hearing people screaming racial slurs scared me even more." A seemingly shy girl, Ashley Rayburg, used to take the bus with Justin to Avon View High School in Windsor. She declined to be interviewed but expressed her fears in her victim impact statement. "When I ran up to my mom, I was shaking so bad and became hysterical," she wrote. Hearing Ashley's alarm, Howe looked through the window and ran outside. "There was a big ball of fire. I walked up to it, close to it, and I had a bat in my hands, and when I got close, that's when I realized it was a burning cross, and I got Michelle to call 911. I will stop there. Not that, you know, this is the first time I've heard about a cross burning, but not only did this happen in Canada, this happened in 2010. So again, this is not ancient history, and this was not old crotchety whites who are about to die. These were very young whites, to the mythology that somehow young white people are cool and they love Drake and they would vote for Obama if they could, or they would vote for him again if they had the opportunity. But they certainly are not racist because they are evolved young white millennials. That is hogwash of the highest order and potentially dangerous. Anywho, if folks have commentary, anything they heard while we had Mr. Morgan, any commentary on what you heard, feel free. Again, since we'll be here tomorrow, there's no need for us to hang out for the whole 3 hours. Any commentary folks wanted to get in?
Hey, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, I want to go back to some of that. Based on that attorney's responses, I am confused that he didn't accept your definition of dedicated to white supremacy. He said a couple of things that made me understand that if he's an attorney, he has to understand that this is a willful participant program. And I'm, Gus, I have to say this, brother. Listening to your show, and I told you this in the email, you've refined me. I'm not that type of guy. So I am trying to get an understanding of how this attorney, who prides himself on words, can say he did understand the word dedication. And all his responses sounded like he understood this, that group in his country, they know damn well what they're doing.
Oh, I don't think there's any disagreement there. I think the issue that he raised from a legal aspect, and some of our other guests who are in the legal profession, I remember from the University of Dayton, Vernelia Randall, particularly because she is a law professor, that it can be very difficult from a legal perspective to prove intention that someone did this deliberately, particularly with racism. It can be very difficult, almost impossible, unless the person, unless you have video of them calling somebody a nigger or, you know, saying, I hate black people. I mean, it's got to be something like that. If you don't have that, it can be darn near impossible to prove that this white person was deliberately practicing racism. They did deliberately intended to harm a non-white person. So from a legal perspective, I understand his hesitancy with that, and that is widespread from a legal perspective. And to me, it makes logical sense, and that's why from a legal perspective, frequently individuals will move aside having to prove intentionality, and they will just look at the result. At least people that are being honest about the difficulty of proving intentionality, they will just move away from whether or not you tried to do this deliberately to this was done and there was harm as a result of this, so you're going to be culpable. That's how people that's how some people from a legal perspective attempt to deal with the issue of racism. But as I told him, I think it's important because I think it must be emphasized that this is white people are deliberately, intentionally terrorizing, abusing black people. I think it's very important that that be stated bluntly because it's true. And I hope that makes sense, my explanation.
It does, sir. And I'm going to ask you this question and I'll mute my line. You're someone, and I'm going to say this first as a statement. You've helped me, and I'm going to keep saying this. You've helped me to understand being refined. I'm 43. I don't think I'm that old. But it's old enough that where I come from, and you asked me about the Kevin Durant situation, I could care less. I'm glad he got out of there in Oklahoma City. Seeing that lifestyle and seeing the people involved in that lifestyle brings me back to what you just said. I'm not questioning you, Gus. I'm just asking, is it okay for us to let our people slide with the concept that for the sake of saving my job, my career, my professional image, I don't want to go on record saying that this is an act of terrorism? How does that help us? And I'll mute my line.
I would just say with Mr. Morgan, I think he did label quite a few of the acts that we talked about. I think he did brand them as terrorism or agree that they were acts of terrorism. I think when I asked him about the Shelbourne incident in Canada, I think he agreed that that it would be more accurate and honest to call that an incident of white terrorism, anti-black terrorism. So I think he did in many instances agree with that. What I would say is that you said how is it productive to let our people, presumably other black people, victims of racism, to quote-unquote let them articulate racism, white supremacy inaccurately or not use the best words in describing what's being done to us? I would say, number one, all non-white people, according to my code, have VGQ. They can say whatever they want to. Even if that means saying that white supremacy doesn't exist, fine, they can do that. I don't have squabbles, and I don't invest time with other non-white people who disagree with my assessment of racism or what words should be employed to describe racism. All of us come to our own conclusions about that. And next, even if I did this, even if I didn't, you know, agree with VGQ, even if I, you know, took the position that, okay, everybody, Anthony Morgan and everybody else, they have to use the exact words that, you know, I think need to be used to describe white supremacy racism. If Anthony Morgan or anyone else, if they choose not to go along with that, what am I going to do about it? What authority, what power, what ability do I have to, you know, make them change their mind, or they're going to be consequent? I mean, can I go and snatch up every black person and put them in the headlock, beat them up, egg their house? I mean, what can I realistically do? Not much as a victim of racism. So that, at least in my view, and I've never heard anybody else step forward and present something that could realistically be done to, you know, correct black people if they are not using the right words or whatever, if they're not doing the right things to end racism. I've never heard anyone step forward with a logical solution that can be implemented to address this problem. So I just go, the logical thing is that we're not going to have universal agreement amongst each other about how to respond to racism. Everybody has VGQ, and we just do the best we can to solve this problem. I hope that makes sense. If it doesn't, then, you know, whomever can step forward and set Gus straight and give us something logical.
Nah, you good, Russ. I love your response. You be right where I expect you to be. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks who had commentary, feel free. Line should be open. Everyone satisfied? No other commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh. Zaya Thomas, I'll go after you.
Oh, what's up, Ross? How are you? I agree with what you just said as well. I mean, what can we do? I think that the level of confusion of, you know, I hate to say it, but I think that we have the least confused black people in the world in America. Which is really sad because we got really confused black people, but the caller from Canada that usually calls in that's on the line, he's not confused. And Cynical African is not confused. So I know that Canada does have some, you know, people that are not confused, but, you know, the guy was a little confused even when I asked him about, give me an example of, you know, white people not knowing they're practicing racism. I mean, his examples were so racist. It was like, and I'm glad what you said, Gus, because I'm thinking, you know, not letting the golf, but just them having a country club is racist. You know, I mean, just the name of it alone sounds very suspect. And I just think that he was on it, kind of, but he just needed to refine himself a little bit more. I think if he was to come live in the States for a little while, he'll get a much better understanding of, with the understanding he has now, he'll have a much better understanding. And like you said, he is a lawyer. He has to codify his speech somewhat because they're trained to do that. They can't help themselves. I noticed that in them. It was funny because I was going to say this tomorrow, but it kind of hit the same topic because this white girl at work who's been trying to push me to, you know, I don't have a problem. I listen to her. She thinks I'm a Trump supporter. And last week I had said something to the effect that they're both racist. So either way, she wanted to know yesterday how come I think Trump is a racist. God. I went right to the, he wouldn't let Obama go to his country club. I mean, she couldn't even respond. Because that country club concept, the whole thing with golf and white people, that's just a racist concept. And I thought the caller was pretty good. I thought that he sounds a lot better than those people up by you, Gus, man. Woo. They're really confused. But he was a little bit on it, I think. I think he got some food for thought tonight. And he'll think about the conversation and maybe refine himself somewhat. I mean, my line, thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to you, Thomas. I'm doing well. I hope everything's good with you. It sounds like it is. And to all other callers and listeners, I agree with Thomas. I think he is he's pretty sharp, but there are areas of confusion that did come out in the discussion. And I don't think he has far to go to really refine his understanding. I don't know if you are in communication with him via email or if you talk to him again. I would just suggest, you know, Dr. Welsh's book, Delectable Negro, Medical Apartheid, like all of those real classic high text, highly educational texts that he can learn from. And I think he would really learn a lot from those things, at least as long as he's in Canada. I think that would help quite a bit. I just found it interesting when he was talking about the black people in Canada, and basically what he described was them seeking white validation, wanting so badly to belong and to be accepted, which is the natural part of the system. I mean, that's exactly what the system is designed to do. It's designed to create hunger and yearning Actually, I hope at some point, you did mention this not too long ago, but I hope at some point we do get to read Delectable Negro so people can really get to understand the idea and concept of consumption and the many myriad of ways that a person or another living thing can be consumed, and how white people do that to us in ways that we can't even fathom and imagine. So I think that that's just something that that is interesting, is that, you know, just the idea of seeking white validation is a form of hunger, and they used to starve our ancestors and to exploit them and also sexually terrorize and abuse them. So to me, that's just a form of consumption, as far as that creating that yearning for white validation, to the point where even you have black people that would discourage the creation of African-centered schools for black people, when we have the most unique experience in the Western Hemisphere as far as the wholesale terrorism. I say the only other group that we can be compared to would be Indigenous Americans, which are just black Americans anyway. So ultimately, we have that unique experience that would really warrant and garner us going in the direction of creating African-centered schools where we can control what ideas and concepts and truths and understandings about our story would be provided to our youth. So to me, it's almost like to me, Canada has a very different view of race, and the black people there just seem to be a lot more confused in certain ways. And I agree with Thomas on the caller in Canada. He's definitely not confused. I think he's actually very, very sharp. So definitely, I think that there's something there. And when he described the issues in the past, as far as the generations that came from the Caribbean, where, you know, the Trinidadians don't get along with the Jamaicans and all of that stuff, that was stuff I grew up hearing as a very young child in Brooklyn. But as I got older, things tended to shift to a more more Pan-African consciousness, I would say. So I would love to learn more about that whole concept of how blackness is viewed and how cohesive or not cohesive that is in Canada. Also, I just wanted to say tonight, the guy Tommy Ford, he played Tommy on Martin, he died tonight. And I find it interesting, they said he died from complications after knee surgery. So again, this is another casualty. He was very young. I don't know his exact age, but he was very young. And, you know, knee surgery, I mean, you're going for knee surgery, a black male, you come out, you die. The system is just murderous. And again, I don't believe any black people die of natural causes. Even if they die with a smile on their face, this system is trying to kill us all. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
He was 52. Very young.
Wow, 52. Jeez. Wow, unbelievable. My grandfather died at 53, so, and he had a massive heart attack, and that's in Trinidad. But yeah, that's unbelievable. Wow. I'll meet my line, but rest in peace.
For sure. I did want to make sure I included, just that is a trend over the years. And I mean, like, going back to 2010, 2011, in just doing this program, as we talked to more black people outside the States, Canada and different parts of Europe and other parts of the world, that has been like glaringly consistent throughout the years. People from other parts of the world saying that they think black people in the States are a little bit less confused than the black people wherever they happen to be, respectively, on the globe. That has been very consistent. I can't even think of an exception to the rule. Maybe Rochelle DeCoste, she was a guest on the program earlier this year. She's also a Canadian resident, black Canadian. But even the incidences that she cited that really influenced and got black people in Canada mobilizing, I think she cited a protest that took place in 1992, they were responding to the Rodney King trial or the trial for his beating in 92 and the riots and everything. They were articulating solidarity with black people here in the U.S. So that is a major trend that I've seen. That, too, was disheartening for me because I always thought, wow, black people here are so confused and trying to get our act together. But consistently, black people in other parts of the world have said that they think black people here are way, way less confused than black people wherever they happen to be. Anybody else have commentary they want to get in? Anybody that we haven't heard from yet have anything they want to share? A everyone satisfied?
Well, I just want to say, I think it's the sex element that I can imagine in Canada, it's a lot of, it's not a lot of black people to start with, but it's a lot of interracial stuff that goes on there. And I think that, kind of goes on worldwide in places where black live in white countries, and I think that's what kind of is the difference with, we have that one drop rule here, and even though there is Area 8 activity, we kind of deep down know that, we could have got killed for that, So I think that makes a big difference, that Area 8 activity. And also, I just wanted the clarity. Did he say that in Canada, they can't have their own African stuff because they have this all-inclusive type society where you can't have your, own culture going on? It has to be Canadian?
I think he articulated, I guess that's the ethos or supposed to be a major theme that's promoted, that we're multicultural and so everyone is supposed to participate and be a part of the fabric of being Canadian, that sort of rhetoric. So yeah, that influences, I guess, black people in particular, since that was the context of the question. Some black people there rejecting, saying, yeah, let's have an exclusively black institute of some sort, school or whatever it is. We should have something that's going to be for all Canadians. I think he did articulate that.
That's fine. Very fine.
And it's not as many black people. I think that's huge. I think any environment where you have a significantly smaller population of black people, it's been my experience that the confusion tends to be a lot worse. I can take Washington. I was not born in Washington State, okay? So, and I think about that all the time. If I was born here, I think I would be a lot more confused, because just being in that environment, unless you have parents and family that are very informed about racism and they make a deliberate effort to kind of shield you from having a lot of contact with racists at a young age, so you're not hanging out in white people's houses and that sort of thing, unless you had that, you're going to grow up and have probably friends that you've had since you were 2 or 3 that are white, and hanging out in their houses and, girlfriends and dating and sexual activity with whites and going to party. You're just going to have a whole experience of growing up, your formative years, with that sort of inculcation to not thinking of individuals who classify themselves as white as enemies of black people. So, and it's very, very, because then you have a lot more emotional ties connecting you to a variety of whites, if they're not even in your family, that makes it very, very difficult to have an accurate understanding of what racism is, how it works, what it means to be classified as white. It's going to be very, very hard if you've grown up and lived in that environment, particularly for your formative childhood years. Anywho, we will be here again tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The caller at 4243, did you have a comment you needed to get in? Or?
Yes, just a quick one. I was actually thinking about that when you were talking. So do you think that it is safe or productive or what have you for black people to have white friends to try to solicit or somehow get information from them? Because I know that I have, for instance, with my job, like most of us, we do interact with a lot of non-black people, and I know that sometimes they do slip up and they'll say things, and I try to remain codified, but at least it gives me a glimpse at how they are. There was this one time this one white woman said that mixed people have the best skin, and it kind of made me think, okay, well, I guess, does that mean that I'm too burnt or something? So it kind of gives me a glimpse, but do you feel that is safe, or would you recommend it, or is it better to just kind of just engage on a work level and not take it outside of it?
My suggestion is, I think I think it is a compromise of a black person's safety, maybe even that black person's sanity, anytime that we begin to think of a white person as a friend under the system of white supremacy. I think if we work with whites, and as you stated, many of us do, I'm not saying that you know, have to be antagonistic towards them. I'm not saying to be hostile. I think workplace racism, I state consistently, you want to be courteous, you ask for the job, and, you know, you need to be able to get along in that space to maintain the job. So you're courteous to them, you're not aloof, you speak, good morning, all that, you know, keep it. I recommend keeping the conversation as much as possible focused on work-related subjects and not just personal gabbing. But I do not think that it is constructive, safe, or sane to begin thinking of them just because you work with this person as a friend. I would even say that applies to non-white people as well, but especially whites. This is just, you know, a coworker that is probably a racist that I'm working with and trying my best to make sure I can minimize conflict and be on this job and keep an eye out in case they're doing anything to me. And that's the getting really to the crux of the reason. I think once you start thinking of them as this is my white friend, I think it's much easier to have lapses where we don't suspect them of a racist, and they will get us. They will commit an act of white supremacy, and we might be a little bit surprised, not prepared, caught us off guard. I was thinking that this person was cool, or I just wasn't thinking of them in that manner. I think it's much healthier. It puts us in a better position to respond however we want to, even if that's not saying anything, when they make those type of comments like, oh, yeah, like the people that, you know, mixed children or what have you, they have the best skin complexion, with what is implied about someone who has a high amount of melanin like yourself or whomever else. That's just the way that I think about it. I think it would be most accurate from a counter-logic perspective that whites are not our friends. The white people that we work with, class with, meetings with, whatever the case may be, even if a white person should save your life, that this person, if they are white, this person is probably a racist, and regardless of what they have done for me, what our experience has been, I'm going to expect that they are probably going to do something racist at some point. I'm going to be on guard for that, and I'm going to interact, conduct myself around this person as though this is an enemy to black people. I think that's the healthiest way to go. It makes the most sense, given the environment we live in. Hope that makes sense.
Oh, yes, it does. Thank you. That's all I had.
Grand.
Hey, Gus, before you hang up, I want to say this. As an employer, I've hired white men into my company. I've been very diverse as a construction builder. I want to say this, since you said that, is that I hired a young man about 27 years old who was a veteran at the time. This is 2014. One day he said to me, while we were neighbors across the street, he said to me one day, how do you know if you're having a black or white baby? He said, if you stick a tampon up the pregnant woman's vagina, if the cotton tip doesn't come back, then you know you got a black baby. Now, I'm paraphrasing, okay? And I want to say this before I hang up. Gus, look, man, I would support you as a candidate for any role, but particularly as a president, and I'm done.
Right on. Make America great again. Right on.
I agree.
we'll be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Again, the anecdote that was just shared, in my view, you can't share something like that and be ignorant about racism. You can't share a joke like that and be unconscious of racism. I can't even say it's folly because it's so dangerous. That has been consistent. Three consecutive days we've had a black guest asserting in some way, shape, or form that white people are stupid, white people are ignorant about racism. That's why I said it's not about any individual non-white person, because that is such an accepted concept. It is such a dangerous bit of rhetoric when people begin talking about what racism is and how it works, thinking that whites are ignorant. That is, nothing could be further from the truth. White people are experts. If you're white, you cannot be ignorant about racism, and you cannot function in that manner, telling that sort of quote-unquote joke, if you don't understand racism and how you're supposed to think about, relate to niggers. And that's worldwide, Canada, U.S., wherever you happen to be in the universe. We will be here tomorrow, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. If you have anecdotes that have happened on your job, you can email them, untiljustice@gmail.com, and we will share them on the program. We'll be looking forward to hearing from folks tomorrow. No spectators, dial in and share what you have seen, experienced, particularly if you figured out some things to work to neutralize racist activity on the job. If you have any questions, guest suggestions, if you have problems, if you can't find something in the archives or just general gripes, feel free, email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. War is being waged against black people in all areas of people activity worldwide. Our behavior should reflect that at all times. In my view, that would mean being able to make the best possible decisions to save our lives, keep ourselves as safe as possible, and just understanding we could be under direct attack at any moment. And that is from a race soldier badge or no. You never know when today will be the day that you stumble into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson. Again, race soldier badge or no. Take it seriously what racism, white supremacy means, and sobriety would be best. That means no cigarettes, cannabis, alcohol, anything else that they come up with. It would be best if we can function sober, productively to solve this problem immediately. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.